Hello, and welcome to Crit Club, a podcast where four friends watch a film that they haven't seen from the Criterion Channel and talk about it. My name is Wizard Chris, and this week, as always, I am joined by my three incredible co-hosts. I have Angela.
Hello.
I have Mr. Peter Allen Clark.
Hello. I love rolling R's. Three.
Very good, right? And I have Corey.
Hello, I'm Corey.
Never mind. This week, we are sliding Indiana Jones style under the door of Halloween just to get a little something in before spooky season's ends. This week, we are watching Abel Ferrara's 1995 film, The Addiction. Equal parts a drug addiction metaphor, a story of religious sin and redemption, or is it a Sopranos pre-union? Starring Lily Taylor.
Oh, that was my joke.
Starring Lily Taylor, Christopher Walken, Edie Falco, Michael Imperioli. Lots of folks are in this. And I am super excited to talk to you guys about this today. I chose this movie to get something a little spooky in, or at least what I thought would have been a spooky movie. But also, I am a big fan of Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant. I think it is one of the more interesting movies that I've seen, and I was curious to see what his take on the vampire lore, legend, and myth would be. Did he disappoint? Did he not? Impossible to say. I have thoughts about this movie, but I would love to start talking to my co-hosts about it. And so I will start with Peter. What did you think of The Addiction? Did you find yourself wrapped in its warm blanket feel, or did you kick it like a bad habit?
Good one. I like that one. I was excited to react to other people rather than lead it, so I'm not sure what to say. Let's see. This movie was something that I watched. It was about 90 minutes.
Oh, I like that, Peter. I like where this is going.
I don't know. I guess I'm still mulling over a little bit about this movie, but I don't really want to mull over too much. I think broad thoughts is I didn't connect with this movie very much. And every so often, it would like emerge on the periphery of my connection and loom its way out of the shadows and perhaps bear its fangs at my neck, but then it would make a choice, or the writing would happen, or some other function would occur, and I would flee and get my distance from it. I think I see a lot of value in it. I think that it's a really interesting depiction of vampirism, and I also wonder how much I'm just colored by the time when this was made, we weren't as inundated and flooded with, vampires as we are now. But I'm not sure. Like, I think this movie has a lot of amateurish flaws that I found a little bit difficult to get away from. But that being said, I still found it interesting and engaging enough in its exploration of its personal philosophy. Let's see. The Addiction is a movie made by a very depressed person.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And I think that there are two types of movies that can spring for that. That's very limiting, but bear with me. I think there are a lot of movies made by very depressed people that can explore and try to understand their own depression and try to make sense of it, or at least find some sort of artistic communion with the viewers. And then there are what I felt about this movie, which is this is one of those really bad Lars von Trier versions where he's wanting to drag me down with his depression in a lot of ways. I don't know. That maybe is a little harsher than I feel about it, about the movie as a whole, because I don't think it was an unsuccessful movie. I just felt myself distanced from it more often than not. Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There you go. Mm-hmm.
Interesting use of the word communion. We'll probably want to talk about that a little bit later. Angela, what did you think of The Addiction?
I feel a lot of the same way Peter does in terms of the distance, and the film is really trying to keep you away. This is not your glamorous vampire movie. This isn't your delicious revelry in the glamour and beauty of vampires. These are some ugly ass motherfucking vampires who are really rooted in evil and in the evil of humanity. It's much more of an intellectual exercise, really, than a pleasurable viewing experience. Mm. You may recall a few weeks ago when we were watching, what was that French movie? The Irma Vep movie, where they were saying, you know, what's with all these intellectual European French movies? When are we going to start entertaining people again? And this is one of the intellectual, kind of like a real deep dive into the banal evil of humanity. And what does it take? How do we make such atrocious choices that hurt others intentionally and watch them and not care? Because we talk a lot about how in this film it's kind of a comparison to heroin addiction, but both of those addictions are really a larger comparison to the evil of humanity in terms of there's a lot of shots about the Holocaust, like some of the most gruesome war-based cinematography I've ever seen, like found footage, which is apropos for right now with what's happening in Gaza and in Israel. So I found that intellectually interesting to me. Like, what is it? What does it take for us to disregard each other's humanity? And like, are we addicted to that evil so that we can get what we want, make what we want happen? Right. In these the cases of the vampires, it's like sucking blood for heroin addicts. It's, you know, shooting up. And so I tuned into that sort of thing. But overall, so much of it was so mundane, which I think is interesting, this notion of vampires as not very interesting creatures. But it didn't make for a really engaging film experience, at least not until Christopher Walken showed up. Once Christopher Walken showed up, I was like, oh, finally, someone's going to tell us all what to do here. And I will say that this isn't just a Sopranos prequel. This is like an HBO CSI unit, or what is it? The Crime Victims prequel, because Catherine Irby is in this too.
So true.
Which I'm like, oh my God, look at her. She's so young. And
it's
like
all these New York actors. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm addicted here.
And then also Lily, what's that actress?
Lily Taylor.
Yeah. She was also, I kept thinking about Six Feet Under. Like,
Six Feet Under, I did too. Yeah,
the
yeah, me
same
too.
Kind of facial expressions. Not that she is a flat actress in any way, but like the pathos that she, was really interesting. It put me right back watching some things in Six Feet Under. It was an okay movie. Wasn't the worst movie I've ever seen. Not the best movie. I was intellectually, it turned on some things in my brain. And I'm excited to hear what, you know, whether you guys saw some of those things as well. Looking forward to it. Corey, I think it's your turn, right?
I'm just going to start off and say that I don't like zombie rules for vampires. I think that turning a vampire should be like a thing that you have to do intentionally to do and not just like, I get bit by a vampire, now I'm a vampire.
Yeah.
That's zombies. And that's a whole different other thing. So like if a vampire has to eat and they have to like hide in society and like sneak around and be, you know, surreptitious and all that stuff, like you're not going to want to turn every single meal that you have into another vampire.
It seems like they kill their victims. Like they're supposed to kill
their victims.
I guess
except that party at the end, all those people that she was feeding on just showed up and stuff.
She created an army of vampires.
This is why you need a vampire trainer, you know? That's why everyone needs a walk-in.
You're talking about exponential growth. You're going to run out of people on the planet within a week. Like, it's just not going to be sustainable. So I don't like zombie rules for vampires, first of all. That pissed me off.
Noted.
The second one is, this movie just felt like it was made by like a college sophomore or something like that.
Like, it felt like I was listening to a dude who took two classes in philosophy and was way too confident
it's
about
like, I know a couple of names of some authors. I really don't know how to properly quote them or digest them and represent their ideas in an interesting way. But yeah, I know some names. It felt like a senior film project, like their final senior film project for film school or something like that. Like, and I'm surprised. I mean, this is kind of like in the middle of Abel Ferrara's career. I mean, he had made, you know, Body Snatchers and Bad Lieutenant and all that stuff by now, but this all just felt very like, I don't think the philosophy was ever like used very well in this. Like, it's sort of the framing device of it and stuff, but it's, you know, and it kind of presents like, you know, are we evil or do we just do evil things? But like, the main character never wrestles with any of this. Like, she turns into a vampire and she's immediately just a vampire and she's a baddie for the whole time. And I don't think she ever stops to think even once about if what she's doing is bad or if she's now inherently bad or she's just, I don't know. There was none of that, like nothing. And so like that whole framing device felt like kind of wasted potential. And like the whole stuff with like the war crime photos and all that, and the, you know, Vietnam and Holocaust and all that stuff. Like, I don't know. These are real people. These are real people that this actually happened to, and you're just going to flash images of this through your movie, and you're not going to do anything with that or about that or say anything really about it at all. Like, if you're going to use the images of those real people in your movie, then you should have a reason to where if I took all those images out, it wouldn't just be the exact same movie. Like, they should be there for a reason. If you took all those images out, we would have the exact same movie and the exact same conversation here. I don't think it added anything to it. I don't think they said anything interesting about it. I don't think, like, it was really warranted. And it was just kind of there to, like, the whole thing felt like an edgelordy movie. Like, it just felt like edgelord type of, you know, I'm 22 years old and I don't know how old he was, but it felt like someone who was like 22 years old, took a couple philosophy classes and decided to make an edgy movie about vampires and stuff. And it was just like, I don't know. I think the cast was good. I mean, like, I guess Abel Ferrara had enough, like, cachet to get a lot, like a really good cast together and stuff.
This is like movie maybe 2 or 3 of 5 that he did with Christopher Walken. Like,
about Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken was not in this movie. He was all over the marketing material. I mean, you see it on the Criterion Channel. It's his face. It's his face on the Criterion Channel, like, you know, slate thing to click on. And he's there for one scene. And I guess the one scene is there to show that, like, it's possible for her to live a life where she's not being a vampire. But she, again, even though he presents it like here's a viable alternative, I'm doing it, she never even considers, like, maybe I should listen to this guy and maybe I shouldn't stop being evil. Like, there's no internal struggle here. She's just a barreling bullet that gets fired at the beginning of the movie, and there's nothing to ever sort of stop her in the way. So
I definitely want to come back to that scene with Christopher Walken, because there's a lot to... I think, to unpack in that.
So,
Wizard.
How about you, Wizard?
Yeah. Wizard, what did you think?
You know, I've much the same. I feel like we're all sort of in agreement in a lot of ways. I found this movie to be, like, interesting in a lot of ways. It's visually very interesting. It is trying to say something, I think, about, you know, as we've sort of talked about already, you know, the banality of evil, or it's asking like a sort of philosophical question, like, are we inherently evil, or are we evil because we do bad things, or we do bad things because we are evil, is kind of like the
I'm gonna come back to that
the hinge of the movie, or like something that gets asked. And again, I don't know if it necessarily wrestles with that. You know, I think that Ferrara and the writer, a guy named Nicholas St. John, are both men with very deep roots in Catholicism and in Christianity. St. John notably wouldn't work with Ferrara on Bad Lieutenant because of some of the sacrilegious imagery, including the assault of a nun, that plays in that movie. And when I started thinking about the film in those terms, I was like, oh, this is like the most like medieval idea of humanity I think that I've seen expressed in a film. Like Ferrara seems to be saying that we are inherently evil creatures, driven by appetites and thirsts, and we would do evil if not for, like, capital G grace through Jesus, through the Catholic Church. And when I started thinking about it like that, I was like, oh, that's why this movie makes me feel so ugly. Like, I need to take a shower and, like, get a Brillo pad and go to town. Because, yeah, it is a movie that does not make you feel very good about people. And that's its design. Ferrara doesn't feel good about himself. He feels terrible about being an addict for so long. He feels terrible about humanity in general. And his sort of... the sort of thesis of his film is that grace and redemption can be found through sacrament, through the church, maybe. Maybe there are other ways. I haven't talked to the man. I would be curious to see what he thinks. But yeah, the philosophy stuff, the sort of NYU philosophy stuff, didn't really land with me. I did find my eyes kind of glazing over. And because so much of the dialogue is Lily Taylor making these, like, pronouncements that are grounded in, like, Heidegger and Sartre and stuff that, like, I read, but I don't have an opinion on that's, like, super valuable. And I don't feel like she does either.
I was doing the opposite of glazing over. Whenever they started talking about it, like, I was laser focused in, because I'm like, wait, are they actually going to say something interesting about it?
And same. I was with you. I'm with you.
And I'm pretty sure
it was just there as set dressing.
And, yep. And you know, if the movie is a metaphor for heroin addiction, I appreciate the commitment to, like, she's just, like, ranting about stuff that she's read. And as a character moment, I'm kind of like, okay, like, she is, like, losing her mind. She is, like, falling into this thing. And she's just kind of on these, like, unhinged, like, quote-unquote, like, addict rants, you know? But it does make for interesting dialogue, and it doesn't necessarily make for an interesting film. Although, I did find this film pretty interesting. Yeah, I do want to say that I do feel not great about the use of, like, the war atrocity footage. Like, they use from the My Lai massacre and from the Holocaust and from the war in Bosnia. I think that they're used effectively, but I wouldn't have made that choice myself, because these are real people, and I feel that if you're trying to say something about the evil of humanity and you need to reach outside your, like, stage to pull in atrocities from the real world, I would say that you're not making your point as well as you could. Like, you're a storyteller, invent something for me to meditate on the evils that men do or whatever. I felt very stirred and disturbed by some of that stuff, and not necessarily in a bad way. I don't mind being disturbed, but I think that it didn't serve the movie. I don't think that if you took it out, it would be the same movie, but I do think that there are better ways, perhaps, to talk about evil and have a vampire romp at the same time. Speaking of which, the other vampire movie out around this time, Interview with the Vampire. Very different vampire movie.
Very different.
Much sexier vampires. So yeah, overall, I had an interesting time with it. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot to unpack here, even if not a lot happens. Peter,
can we start there? Yeah. Can we start there with... Oh, sorry. Go
ahead. I just want to start at the very, very, very beginning of the movie.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And I have a little rant on this. I hate
so many rants.
I hate movie credits. Like, I think movie credits are, like, stupid and archaic, and we should just get to the freaking movie. Like, I think at the very minimum, you should just flash the name of the movie and then just go. And so when you have, like, just a black background and white letters and it's just going and going, like, stop, come on, no, just get to the movie. And you have to repeat it all at the end too. Like, no. So my preference is just, like, no credits and or just a flash of the title and go ahead. Or, like, a far distant second is like maybe doing some establishing shots or establishing stuff while the like letters are on the screen. But like even then, it's like that's distracting. Like who cares?
This is a real old man yells at cloud.
It really is. It's going somewhere. It's going somewhere. Don't worry. It's going somewhere. I thought that it was interesting because there was a juxtaposition between this and the movie that we watched last week, Hour of the Wolf, that did the same thing with, it was almost the exact same visually of like black with like white letters for the opening credits and stuff. However, Hour of the Wolf, no end credits because they already did it. But they also had that interesting like diegetic sound for going on of like where you could tell like this was him setting up, you know, that he was going to be making a film and all that stuff. So they were doing something interesting there. What did this movie have? This movie had, I think it's literally one of the worst songs I've ever heard in my entire life. I'm not a classically trained musician, but that was really off key singing. Like so much so that it would hurt claws down a chalkboard. So that did not set me off on a good time here.
You didn't like the that opening song slow jam?
No, there was like two guys singing. I think it's better. I think it was Better Off Dead by Fredrero Starr and Sticky Fingers. Maybe it was Onyx. It wasn't Onyx though. I don't know who it was, but that opening song, there were two people singing and one of them just was so off key on it. I realize that we're in 1995 and this is like years before like auto-tune and all that stuff, but like this was nearly inexcusable. Anyway, that's where I wanted to start at the very beginning.
Oh,
okay. I have nothing to add to that.
I think you said it all.
Okay. So let's start at the beginning because I think I do think this movie gets into it pretty quickly and I think in a very effective way. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to talk and about it and to hear from your perspectives of this first encounter with this first vampire, because I think it really sets up what I think is probably one of the most interesting things about the movie being the dynamic of power, right? Power and consent and all these things. There's a repeating motif that I did find to be the most intriguing part about it, which is that question that this vampire asks, like, where she says, tell me to go away, like, tell me to leave. Like, it seemed to me that there's a bunch of blaming the victim and wielding your power in such a way to make it seem like the person who you are overpowering, it's their fault for not being strong enough to withstand you. Mm-hmm. And I really did find that to be very effectively shown in that first scene, or in that first scene with the vampire or whatever, but it also seemed to be just sort of like the rolling motif of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. I think it ties into that idea of, like, you know, how when we experience trauma, some of us can perpetuate trauma. She uses the same lines every time she feeds on Lily Taylor, that is, uses the same lines when she feeds on her victims. And
Christopher Walken said it to her as well.
Yeah.
Whenever they first.
Yeah. You know. And especially when we think about the movie in the context of like a literal addiction, it makes a lot of sense to me that Ferrara is trying to like personify his addiction as vampirism, and all he has to do as the victim of this addiction is just say go away, I don't want you here, I don't need you, and if you could say it with enough conviction and enough like projecting enough strength or whatever, that feeling would go away. And obviously we see that there's, you know, these vampires have agency and we have no way of knowing if that would actually work, but yeah, I definitely I found that recurring line, that theme of all you have to do is just ask them to go and they'll go, kind of like a.
And I do believe there's only one character that doesn't, and that's the Sopranos, Christopher.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Because he's somehow imbued with some sort of sense of spirituality.
Yeah, well, because he's handing out, Jesus pamphlets,
Jesus pamphlets.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm actually liking this movie less now. This is
Yeah, me too.
I liked the first scene, and I liked the tone of it and the sort of like creepiness and the very, I don't know what you call it, where it's the people are looking directly in the camera for both, sort of, you know, it's very like 180 degree. It was very like claustrophobic and intense, and I liked that. At the beginning of a vampire movie, though, like, I, and this is just me being, I don't know, however, just me being Corey, like, I'm looking for the rules. I'm looking for, like, okay, so you're doing a vampire movie. There's lots of iterations. There's lots of variations of this. What are the rules of the universe that I'm existing in so I can know what's going on? And so when she says, like, tell me to go away and all that stuff, I'm like, oh, this is an interesting take because, like, the, you know, trope is that vampires can't come in anywhere.
Invite
they're not invited.
You in. Yeah.
And so now you're saying, like, oh, if you can just, like, uninvite me off of a public alleyway or whatever, like, that's interesting. That, but it ended up, like, I don't think anyone ever used that. No one ever said, so I don't even know if that was just like her just kind of like
Christopher did Sopranos Christopher did
but he never said leave me alone. I don't think he just had, she had no power over him at all. Like, he never said, yeah, like, you're not invited, go away. He was just like, no, thank you, I'm doing this now.
Because everybody, I don't know, everybody wants the vampire. And I think, like, I think that the actors, Lily Taylor especially, she projects this, like, very, like, subdued but very strong, like, sexuality. She's not, like, sexy in the movie or anything like that, but she's intriguing or dangerous, you know? And I think that all of the people who ultimately, like, succumb to the vampires, I think that they, you know, they, even if they said go, they wouldn't really mean it. And I agree that, you know, it's Ferrara's thesis that faith is the thing that helped him at least say no to that and go away to that. So I agree that it's a little, maybe a little hokey that Christopher as a, like, missionary is the only person who is able to just kind of, like, give her the hand wave. No, thank you. I'm out here repping for Jesus right now. I think maybe that, yeah, that can be seen as a little hokey, but I think that it fits well in terms of, like, what Ferrara is trying to say about addiction and evil and our receptiveness to doing bad or dangerous things because they are bad or dangerous.
Yeah, and then I liked, like, after she sort of gets bit, the sort of slow transition, you start to, you know, we were all looking for, like, is there a reflection in the mirror and all that stuff, and at first, I guess, you know, there was, you know, and a couple of the mirrors, but then, like, you know, later scene, like, it's just, like, not there anymore, and, like,
What a funny little effect that was. Of it was very clearly just like a picture of
Super well done, but what are you gonna do? It's a senior film project after all. But I don't know, like, just having her, like, order a salad at lunch and just, like, picking at it, not eating any of it and all that stuff, like, losing interest in food and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah, I like the first little bit of the movie where you sort of weren't sure what's going on and get the broody moodiness and all that.
I really enjoyed.
You can tell immediately that it was.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
You can just tell very immediately that this movie was very self-serious. Like, yeah,
it was very
not
serious
any
movie. Yes.
There's not any levity. There's not even a lot of, like, I don't know. I don't want to say, like, humanity in it. It's just, like,
there's one part of humanity, and that's all the scenes of the streets, like, of her walking through the streets.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, there's some.
And
yeah,
that was my favorite part of the movie. Like, mm-hmm. I felt like I was seeing just life. I'm needing life right now. Mm-hmm. I am overwhelmed with everything that is bad and horrible in the world. And what I want in my cinema is to see people, like, natural people, enjoying their environments. Like, these folks were, like, I think one was in a barbershop or in a, like, a court or something. And that was refreshing in those areas. And sort of to see her kind of try to take down individuals in that. Mm-hmm. Meh. But then it also kind of suggests, like, a certain, everything else in this movie is so kind of dead, that, it's sort of like, now I can't make too many, my brain is kind of burnt out and I'm not capable right now of being able to make huge comparisons, but I just really like those scenes.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, of course. Like, we do see these, like, scenes of life and scenes of activity and. There's a, even in those scenes, there's a dirtiness to it. Like, we are in, like, New York City in, like, the early, like, mid 90s. Like, it feels like, and the black and white, the, like, high contrast lights and darks, like, really make everything seem a lot, like, dirtier, more sinister than they actually are. But yeah, we do see people, like, living. I loved the scenes in they're at like a restaurant, like a pizzeria or cafe or something. When she goes to pick up her her new friend, whose name escapes me. His name is Black, and it's just like this brightly lit pizzeria in like the dead of night, and like this beautiful contrast between her outside and everybody inside, and then they like,
yeah, it's like my life going to that pizzeria. I love it.
Love
I believe it was Gyros or Heroes.
I would love to talk about some of the philosophy that they do try to unspool.
Please.
because again, it was like it was a slow transition for me with this movie because I really was engaged and I really was feeling it until it sort of revealed itself to be sort of an emperor with or a movie with no clothes on. But because I was like captivated by the first discussion of determinism, like in free will, and that seems to be something that is discussed often. But again, I think it's for me, it had no purpose or boundaries. It was just another way of saying all humans are evil and we're evil because we're human and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, and she, I think Lily Taylor's character like denigrates free will a couple times, or, you know, and it seems like this is just sort of a foregone conclusion, and it's preaching to what it considers to be a choir of viewers that are like, look at these idiots believing that determinism isn't real. And I do think I like that analogy within the bounds of addiction, within drug addiction, and like feeling yourself, or, you know, not only physically, genetically predisposed to addictive personalities or addictions, but also culturally, you know, community-wise, socially, sort of like happenstance, unable to avoid those addictions. I did like those phrasings and the philosophical meanderings through the lens of its specific metaphor, but I think it relied on them too much until that crutch broke.
That's fair. That's very fair. Yeah, I didn't connect with any of the philosophical aspects of the film, or like the parts where we're supposed to, like, I guess, ruminate on what's being said. And I don't think, you know, I think that the philosophy matters less, especially in the context of the sort of the end of the film, because this is a movie about a very specific kind of redemption. This is about
yeah,
like Catholicism,
Christian redemption. Asking for God's forgiveness,
yeah,
and you will be resurrected, as in the last frame.
Which, yeah, again, is a fine thesis, but it does render a significant portion of your movie to not, like, so much of that dialogue doesn't matter because there's no, like, and religious scholars, write in. I don't know anything, but free will in Catholicism is kind of not so much, right?
There's belief in free will in Catholicism,
and I'm sure that in the context, I'm sure that some of these philosophers are probably like religious folks who have thoughts on free will and determinism and all that kind of stuff. But Ferrara is like, the problem of evil and free will doesn't even really matter to him, because what matters is getting that wafer at the end and repenting and redemption and grace. And so this movie isn't even about like problems of free will or anything like that. It's about doing bad things and feeling sorry for them later.
I don't know who they were talking to. I just don't know who the fuck they were talking to. It like really fucking annoyed me. Sorry, Angela, what?
They're talking to addicts. I've been sitting here thinking, I'm like, there's so much we don't understand about this film. Like, just like I watch European films and I'm just like, I don't get some of this stuff. I feel like a lot of this we can't get because we are not like full-blown like addicts who needed significant intervention to not die. So I think that can be a pretty legit reason why some of this just is like not registering. I think another part of it is that the religious aspect is alienating. And whenever you put a particular religious perspective in a spiritual context, you're going to alienate a huge portion of people. Just you're going to write off a huge part of your audience, which is just, I think, bad storytelling. Unless you're a Catholic and you want to you know, evangelize and get more Catholics in the world.
Well, I don't think not he wants something to do either.
I'm into. I disagree.
Peter.
Yeah.
No, I disagree with both of these points. I think like because I'm talking about, I don't know who he's talking about with or who he's talking to with all of this philosophical sort of meanderings. Because to me, as I understand it, as I heard it, and as I said in my introduction, this is a depressed person who made this, and it seems like they want to talk about the phrase being and nothingness more than they want to talk about what that Sartre book actually entails or means, you know? Like, there have been a few movies that we've discussed recently where I've been over the moon about its existentialism and how much I personally subscribe to all of this sort of, like, existentialist philosophy and how I really enjoy seeing identity and self and oblivion sort of put side by side. But I don't think this movie either is not interested in sort of delving further behind a title of a book, or maybe doesn't know enough to sort of explore those realms. The only philosophy that it does adhere to and does want to explore is Christianity. And I don't feel personally distanced by Christian themes. You know, for all my 13 years of Catholic schooling, somehow I came out without any sort of like real chip on my shoulder against Catholicism. Corey, you and I've talked about this. Like, I still very much like am fascinated by a lot of Christian theology and especially Catholic theology. And I'm always like I think they're very rich themes. I think the idea of resurrection through the very last line talks about sort of exposing yourself in the light of God and losing the self to oblivion. I think that's a very rich theme that isn't explored in this movie until the last, you know, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I think this movie just felt like it was all over the place, and maybe the writer and director weren't in the same place with all of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you, I think, Peter. I don't find Christian themes to be alienating I think you guys were doing some eye rolling earlier at some of the Christian themes or the Catholicism of this film. And I mean,
no Catholic is going to be on the street handing out pamphlets.
Well, very true, especially in New York in the 90s. My goodness. But like, I believe in grace as like a personal experience. You know, I believe I believe people find God every day, and good on them. I hope it compels them to good things instead of bad things. I just, you know, If you do look at this film as like I don't know how old Ferraro was when he made this. I don't know a ton about him as a person, but like, if you look at this movie as we have a little bit, as kind of like a sophomore film school venture, then
he was 43, 44.
Okay.
How old was the St. John guy?
I mean, maybe the same, who knows. Yeah, I think the point is that this is maybe someone who has found their faith again, which gives an equally like unstudied sophomoric sort of read on Christianity and on grace and on evil and all that stuff. Like, this is someone who is like, this is somebody who found God yesterday and wants to tell you about God today. Like, they've been walking with God their entire lives. You know, there's no one as fanatical as like a new convert. It has that kind of vibe, even though I don't think this is a fanatical Catholic film. I think it just hinges on Catholicism and on faith as the only, or at least for this character, for this director in this situation, as the thing that broke them out of this like this evil mold that we're all cast in or something.
Was there no Catholicism or Christianity before like the last like 10 minutes or something?
No, there were
crucifixes and stuff around.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There's some.
Yeah. And there was that priest that comes visit her in the hospital and
at
stuff.
At the very, very end.
Oh, that was at the very end.
It's like the very, very
end. It really is. It really is like the last, like from the blood orgy on is where we start, like just before the blood orgy when Christopher makes his appearance. From that point on, sorry to Michael Imperioli, who's an excellent actor, and but you'll always be Christopher to us. From that moment on, that is when we start really leaning into Catholicism, into faith. I think it's in part, like, the movie's shown us some pretty heinous stuff up until this point. And I suppose we are, as viewers, supposed to be like, well, what's the solution here? What is the cure, or what is the panacea for evil? Good news, kids, it's Jesus, and he's been right there the whole time.
I just want to say, I looked it up, and Nicholas St. John was like 21 or 22 when he wrote this.
So, amazing.
So well, senior film project.
Can I, this Prime movie reminded me a lot of Clerks. I thought so much about Clerks.
Oh, Clerks is so good.
Is it?
Clerks is great. I've rewatched it within the last like 6 months. It still holds up. It is really great.
That is a movie I am 100% afraid to return to, because I know I'm not going to like it as much as I did when I was like 17, 16.
It's really great. I do not like a lot of most of Kevin Smith. Clerks, damn good.
I feel like I have the same problem, because I've also, I think I rewatched it a couple of years ago or something. And
is
I did
it black
not,
and white?
Did not love it. No. I'll tell you why. I've actually got a quote here from The Addiction. No, because The Addiction, like Clerks, feels dreadfully overwritten. Like, overwritten to the point of, like, why are you saying these words? You're saying these words because you think they sound smart, not because it's good dialogue at all. There's this fucking, in The Addiction, that we're watching, like, I wrote it down because I was so, like, aghast by it. Like, this is when the vampire who turned Lily shows up in her hotel room, or, like, shows up in her hospital room and closes the blinds as she's, like, trying to kill herself or something. And the vampire says, I didn't write down all of it, but she says something like, are we sinners because we sin, or do we sin because we're sinners? And then she says, and I quote, in more accessible terms, are we evil?
With.
Like, and it's just like, what the like, it is so overwrought and overwritten, and it's like explaining things to me that it doesn't seem to fully understand in a way that, like, also Clerks, like, what, stop it with these words, like, what are you doing, calm down.
In my notes, it just says, nobody talks like this, in all caps.
Yeah, but, like, I think this is nobody talks like this because this is a young writer and he's still learning and wasn't very good. Which also probably with Clerks as well, but I think Clerks leaned into it for comedic sake. It was a comedy.
I would agree with that. I would agree that it had more of a sense of its own self than this movie did. Do you want to talk about the blood feast orgy?
No, I think before we do that, we should talk about the Christopher Walken.
I would like to talk about the Walken of it all. Yeah.
So this is when I was like, this movie is made by a prime edgelord. Like, because, like, just the part where he's like, have you read Naked Lunch? Like,
sure.
Could you write a copy on my desk? Yeah, could you, as a 21-year-old screenwriter, write a more perfect line to tell you that I'm 21 years old? Have you read Naked Lunch? I cracked up laughing.
I did too.
Oh dear. I liked Christopher Walken's role in the film, though. I thought he was like, this is a movie filled with characters who are not super interesting, and his character is not super interesting either necessarily. But I liked his sort of like walk on role. He is a vampire who has, like the Tibetans, learned to subsist on like nothing. He's like, oh, I have a job, I go to the bathroom, I can eat, like, I'm living the good life. He is in The Addiction as a story about addiction. He is the guy who is like, yeah, I kick the habit. I do heroin sometimes, though. And we see that he goes on this big like spiel about how he's in control of his appetite and he is more and more human every day. But what does he do after that speech? He drinks Lily Taylor's blood and he feels like a million bucks. He is a hypocrite and a liar. And, you know, excuse me, in the context of the movie, we are all hypocrites and liars, except for those of us that have found redemption and grace. but I liked how the film presents like hypocrites and liars in the context of addiction, or in the context of faith, or in the context of being a vampire. Like, I liked this vampire character who's like, I am mostly human, but every once in a while I get down and I drink some blood because I got to. It's great. So I liked him as a character who is not completely in control of his hunger or of his addiction, but thinks he is and is so down to tell you about it.
Or pretending to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Corey, I don't agree. I don't believe you about Nicholas St. John. I think he was well above 21.
Oh, is that true?
I'm not, yeah, because he like helped co-write the 1976 movie Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy.
Yeah, they started writing together when he was 16 years old.
Okay, so that was in 76 then.
So
this is 20 years after that.
So he's 36. Okay.
Maybe 36. I found the wrong one. Googling around.
Sorry. I just wanted to clarify that for readers who were yelling at, or listeners who were yelling at us. But I agree with you, Wizard. I think this movie has a subtlety about some of those themes that I don't know if it even understands or recognizes sometimes. Mm-hmm. Maybe it does. Maybe I'm just missed more of the broader ones. If we don't want to talk about it just yet, but I did love the blood orgy scene. But I think what I loved most about it, as it in the ramp up to it, was seeing all of these random people that she had bit, like, and just because it doesn't come right out and say that these people stuck with her or these people are around, but to me that felt very true to an addiction community or to a community. But, you know, like of all sorts of manners of people who are drawn, who all have one thing in common, and that is their own addiction. And I felt that sort of haphazard, wayward community and how understated it was to be pretty powerful.
Yeah.
And then they all freak out and bite everyone.
I love that it's at like a doctoral dissertation party. Like the movie has...
It hates academics.
Yeah.
But still wants to be one.
Yeah, it uses all this academic language. Like, you don't accidentally make your protagonist like an NYU philosophy master's without having thoughts about academia and philosophy and all of that. But like, it doesn't. The whatever it's trying to say about academia. I suppose that it's just so much like navel gazing and thumb twiddling.
That's also what I'm talking about. Who is this movie talking to? Mm-hmm. Like, there's that scene in the library where it's her voiceover and she says, "We're drawn to it like flies." I'm like, no one's fucking ever talked about a library like this. Like, who are you speaking to? the library where all the most wretched people are drawn to.
Ew,
like flies.
The NYU library. gross. I agree. Like, who is this talking to, and to whom or to what institution are your beefs with academia and philosophy in particular? Like, to whom or to what institution is that directed? Because I understand, like, a good neo-noir voiceover, with the exception of Deep Cover, I think it works great all the time. But but again, like, so much of the dialogue just breaks over me without really landing in any meaningful way. And this is an intensely visual movie. It's like constructed well, and it's like the cinematography in this film is really, really great. And so I enjoyed watching it, but like listening to it, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of my experience too.
What did you all think about the cinematography, especially compared to Hour of the Wolf, which we watched last week? I think they're two different. They're supposed to be two different stylizations, but I was curious how you all felt about one use of black and white over another.
This movie is always very close. This movie just felt like it was always very like claustrophobic and contained. I feel like Hour of the Wolf had. It had close-up shots, especially when he was sort of in with the demons. Everything felt tighter, and like there was more just like faces up in the screen and all that stuff. But when he wasn't with the demons or whatever, there were just like lots more expansive shots with like big, you know, detail and wide lenses and all that stuff. So I don't know. I think that this one overall had, so we kind of went back and forth, I guess, to the feeling of the sort of depth of field and framing with Hour of the Wolf. This one always just felt like it was, you were always really close. It was a lot of mid shots, a lot of close ups. At least that's what I'm kind of recalling here. Mm-hmm. So,
Angela, what did you think about it? I was curious about what you watched of Hour of the Wolf versus this.
Oh, I didn't like Hour of the Wolf at all.
Well, the cinematography I'm talking about.
Both. I mean, the difference is that most of this film, The Addicted, is shot at night. And mm-hmm. so I just found it's not easy to shoot at night. And I'm assuming they did actual film, right? Like celluloid, not digital. And so when you're doing that, you know, you don't necessarily, like, you have to measure everything perfectly. You have to set up your shots perfectly, like, because you're not getting your digital view of exactly what it's looking like. You're waiting till the next day to get your rushes. And so it's actually, the cinematography is pretty incredible, given how crisp it is. Like, I was actually curious about which stock they used, because they had to use something that could absorb light easily and quickly, but could still get those middle tones, if that makes any sense. And so this wasn't, in my opinion, an easy film to shoot, because you're also using a lot of artificial light, less difficult than doing color film, because the color of the lights will impact things, especially like in, say, a pizza parlor or something like that. So I was more impressed by the cinematography in this film than I was in Hour of the Wolf. You know, I think you can still lump these two films together kind of in a similar point of view. You could almost say possibly that this is his attempt at a Ingmar Bergman film.
Ooh, interesting.
And so it's kind of interesting to look at it.
I could buy that.
From that perspective. Otherwise, I mean, this film for me was overwhelming. I've got too much going on to really just really go into blood orgy mode. And it was just so violent. Like, it was intentionally, like, it's not meant to be sexy vampire time. This is not Twilight. This is like, you know, the screaming. I had to mute it because the screaming felt real to me. And I feel like and I know this is crass because it is not done well. None of this is done well. And I agree with what everyone has said about how the use of that, the found footage from like the Holocaust and other atrocities, seems inappropriate in some ways, the way that it's treated. But it still like had the effect of putting me kind of like wondering, you know, how would I actually behave if my life was threatened in a way that I might not be able to control and I'm just trying to survive. And so I felt a lot more sympathy for, say, the victims watching the blood orgy than, say, the vampires, which is what usually you do in a vampire movie, right? Is that you're kind of rooting for the vampires. And in this blood orgy, we are not rooting for the
very much, vampires. Very much a movie where we are not rooting for the vampires. Absolutely. The blood orgy scene at the end was definitely tough. Like, I don't know if it's just the world we live in now, or maybe it's everything, all of the images that the movie had thrown at you up until that point, but I found it deeply disturbing, even though it was, you know, it wasn't super, it's shot very like verite, like matter of factly. Mm-hmm. It's like very like unsexy, unornamented. It's just kind of ends in a blood orgy. And, yeah,
well, and
man.
It's sort of like watching, you know, when we're looking at all that found footage, right? The horrible deeds have been done, right? We see rows of bodies ready to be buried, you know, people trying to be identified. The blood energy is showing us the violence, the actual violence, and how terrifying and horrifying it actually is, which to me, like, put me in a psychological space of maybe almost experiencing the horrors that these people who suffered in these atrocities.
That's really interesting.
That was painful for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, I got it, and it, I actually appreciated the movie more for it, because I feel like it's actually trying to take the experience of these horrors out of what we see in the, these were almost like newsreels. I watched this footage as an eighth grader in my history class. Like, yep. They intentionally made us watch this with the hopes that such things would never happen again. And so when I watched it, I was almost put in that space again, like knowing that this happened. And so I feel like part of this film is about contextualizing these atrocities. It also reminds me of an amazing documentary by Jay Rosenblatt, and I've talked about this documentary many times, called Human the Remains, which is about the boring human details of dictators. I would totally show Human Remains as like a precursor, like as the warm-up for this movie. And so it's for that reason that I feel like I got something much more out of this film, maybe, because it made me sit for a while with... you know, the horrible atrocities that have happened in the 20th century and some of the things that are happening now, and just how it goes beyond more than just a picture or a photograph. It's real terror. There are people screaming and suffering. It's easy for us, and is it an act of evil for us to distance ourselves from that suffering? Yeah, I don't know.
That's very interesting.
Did not like the blood orgy.
But I think that you put some... You put it in like a context that I find really, really appealing. Like, yeah, we've watched this film that deals with the aftermath of like these massacres. And then at the end of the film, it gives us a massacre to kind of sit with. Deals with violent death and more atrocities and that kind of thing. And just, when we started, I did say that I wasn't a big fan of the use of war atrocity footage. But in the context of the rest of the movie, like with that in mind, I do find it now actually to be more fitting and more appropriate, I guess.
I've got a philosophical response to this, because I think Immanuel Kant in his which is he's his own problematic self, but his second his categorical imperative, his second version of the categorical imperative states, and I quote, treat people as the ends unto themselves, not the means to the ends. And I worry that these shots of war victims are treating these people and the plight that they went to as a means to an end, rather than these people as the end of them, at the end of themselves. Like the visions and what we're given of that, these real people who really went to this, is only in service of the filmmakers who are trying to have us feel something. These are where my thoughts are. I don't have a strong opinion about these things, but it still is making me feel a little icky.
I think two things can be totally right in this situation.
Oh, yeah.
I think it can be totally icky.
Very much so.
That these have been used, and that the director maybe was lazy and could not find a better way to make this happen. However, at the same time, in that light, having the experience that I have, having already been exposed to this kind of stuff, and I appreciate that it was shown in the context of being an exhibition. Right. And that we have this philosophical discussion about power and evil and atrocities.
Yeah.
I can excuse it. Right. I am making an excuse. I was made uncomfortable. And I think maybe it was intentional. Maybe like, and I know, like, not just the discomfort of that situation, but also the discomfort of him using that situation, because that in itself is also like a human crossing a boundary for their own purposes, which I think is that in itself inherently evil? Is that the evil of humanity, is crossing boundaries for one's own purposes?
I think it's a valid point. And I think like all of these things we talk about, it's extremely subjective, and I very much respect your opinion.
Man, yeah, that was tough times.
Do we want to talk about the very ending? We've already sort of alluded to it. She She eats communion and then she dies, but she doesn't.
Well, she says, because I rewatched it because I was like, what did I miss? Because this film's acting like something momentous happened when this priest visited. But she just says, God, forgive me. She asks for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be.
Oh, God, am I going to critically fail this movie?
Wow.
Ooh.
That could be interesting. Yeah.
Again, I feel like maybe I was distracted or not paying close enough attention, but it felt like the Christian themes kind of erupted out of nowhere in a way that didn't feel examined or didn't feel earned. That's how I want to say it. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not one to put off or to judge them if they just are there or exist, but definitely if you're going to make leaps like this or like put a bunch of weight and have this be what seemed like a redemptive story arc in the last 3 minutes or something, this didn't feel earned at all to
me. If you're gonna do that and have it throughout the story, then you're just gonna make something that's gonna, you know, end up on like Pureflix or whatever, like the Christian version of Netflix. Oh. Like, so you gotta cram it into the end
the
there.
Best porn.
Get Kevin Sorbo's agent up here. He'll.
Otherwise, you're never going to have an audience for this, really. So.
Oh, I didn't know Pureflix was a thing.
Oh, yeah, Pureflix.
I think that in part, it is a bit unsatisfying, like the introduction of the Christian elements into the film in the last little bit. Although I would argue that we watch a character hit rock bottom and find Christ, which...
Right.
Is
sure
again
sure. That's the story.
This is the story. Well, yeah. This is what happens, especially for some folks who experience addiction or these kinds of like life shattering moments. Like, you hit rock bottom and there is salvation at the bottom if you are willing to ask for it. All you have to do is ask, and that is unsatisfying in some way. Because we've already talked about it, doesn't feel earned. But the point of Catholicism, as I understand it, is that salvation is there. You don't have to earn it. You just have to ask for it.
That's not Catholicism at all. Catholicism is you are a horrible person and you need to spend your entire life punishing yourself for being an inherently horrible person.
Like, no. Grace is.
So I just want to say that I hate this ending. Like, I think that it is like,
what do you feel about credits?
I think it's so horribly. I have another afterthought about the credits also, the second credits. Don't let me forget, because it's even better. It's even better than the first one. Trust me. I hate this, like, it's this predatory nature of religions where you have to, like, if you can't indoctrinate people as little babies and make them think that this bullshit is real, then you have to find people at their lowest point in their lives where they're really out of all options in order to then just like suck them up and indoctrinate them. And so if that's the actual moral of this story, then like, screw you. I hate this movie.
I think we're all living out here on the edge now. I think we've become edgelords, all of us.
Remind us that Catholicism is a vampire trope. It's part of the rules, you know, like holy water.
Right. Transubstantiation, baby.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's used well. I'm just saying, like, it's not like Catholicism just appeared out of nowhere into a vampire movie.
No, that's true. But, like, it would normally, like, kill them or repel them something like that. Not, I guess, make her just a human again? But with a grave? with a grave site? Like... Yeah.
In the most expensive gravesite in the United States, by the way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I don't think a philosophy like PhD student is going to be able to afford that. So,
okay, so I mean, I like I said earlier in this podcast, I do have a lot of fondness, patience, and actual interest in a lot of theology, and I do really love the theme of drinking the blood of Christ. And that theme being communion, as we said at the beginning of this, and Wizard, we said we were going to get back to it. Like, the idea is you are communing with God. You are becoming one with the eternal. You are embedding creation within yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think if this were a more interesting movie or a more curious screenwriter, like, those are themes of what are you doing with the blood? How does the blood of God differ from the blood of humanity? Like, how does that communion differ? There were, like, ways of writing and thinking about this that I just don't feel like were explored.
Now I really want to watch Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Ooh, that's a sexy vampire movie.
It is a sexy vampire
movie.
Maybe
the sexiest vampire movie.
Keanu Reeves is John Wick's vampire.
Oh, dear.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. All right, y'all want to hear my thing about the ending credits?
Sure.
Is it about how, can I guess first? Because I felt a twinge. Were you unhappy with the musical choices at the end credits?
No.
Okay.
I did like the music to this movie,
You're
by the way.
Never going to guess. Okay. You would never be able to
is
guess.
Is it the font? Ooh. Is it the font?
No.
Listeners, write in with your guesses.
No. Watching this movie, and Cassidy looks at like the list of the producers or whatever, and he's like, Anthony Blinken? That's the Secretary of State. Yeah, the Secretary of State of the United States produced this movie.
Do you know who also did?
Russell Simmons.
Hal Dupree's.
Russell Simmons.
So we have Def Jam, and we have the State Department all coming together to make a deeply unsexy vampire movie.
And I just want to plug Cassidy Brown's.
Whoa. It's just crazy just like how much this has come full circle, because like now Anthony Blinken is neck deep in a whole new tragedy and a war atrocity. I can't even right now. But yep. Tell us about Cassidy's new thing.
No, I just wanted to plug his long-running podcast, also All the Answers with Cassidy Brown.
Oh, that's right.
Reaching out to people.
But no, but it's funny because like there are news articles about this where people were like, hey, this guy is going to be the Secretary of State and he made this movie. But it is nowhere on his Wikipedia article. So I've kind of long put up my hat for Wikipedia article editing. But I feel like this is something I might have to like come out of retirement for and add to his biography because it should be on there.
Why wouldn't you want people to know you made this movie?
Yeah, or at least paid for it. Page. There's not even a discussion
about it. Not sexy
enough.
Not sexy enough. Not sexy enough for Anthony Blinken.
Because they got existentialism wrong. Because they denigrate libraries.
They denigrate libraries, and they teach us that self-revelation is annihilation of self, which...
What was the... Does anyone, like... Because I did think this movie had one good point about sort of self-introspection before it veered and did the church... which was about, I wrote it down, but I don't know if I remember exactly the context of like how one affects others' egos and like how that being sort of a true measure of self. I don't fucking know.
Oh, something. Maybe it meant nothing. Something about how we're just like a clash of egos or something like that. Or like.
Yeah. It seemed notable until it didn't, much like a lot of things that were said in this movie.
Yeah.
I'm done talking about this movie.
Perfect. Yeah, I think we've trod over it as much as we can. Let's drive a stake through the heart of this thing. And let's roll on it, people. If you are a new listener to the Crit Club podcast, you may not know that we here at Crit Club do a slightly different rolling or rating scheme inspired by the venerable polyhedral D20, which is the source of much joy and misery for all of us at one time or another. We rate on a 1 to 20 scale, 1 being a complete critical fail and 20 being a critical hit. I have my number ready. I'm sure you guys do too. I would love to start by asking Peter, what did you think of The Addiction?
I think I lent, this is also another one of those movies where talking about it made me like it less. One of the few movies where that actually seemed to happen with this one. Yeah, but it's rare. I feel like I get a more appreciation for it. I ended this movie with a firm 12 in my head. Throughout the course of this conversation, I sunk that down to a 9, but I think I was just emotionally reacting, and I'm good to settle on a 10 because I think because I don't think it was completely unsuccessful, and I don't think this was my time was wasted watching this. I think a solid 10 is fine with me.
For those of you who are new to the podcast, a 10 for most of us, I think, is, well, I didn't completely waste my time. So that's good.
It's neutral. To me, it's neutral.
It's very neutral. Yeah, I don't know.
Angela, what did you think of The Addiction?
Firm 12, because I liked it more than Peter did. I had already in my heart had 12, and then Peter kind of just contextualized that with his 10. And, you know, I got something out of this movie. I didn't love it. And I, you know, we deserve better. I hope someone else makes that film. Or if you can recommend what you think would be the better version of this, please let us know.
It was released the same year. It's called Interview with a Vampire.
You're not wrong.
Thirst is another good vampire movie about guilt.
Have you watched
redemption.
the uh, the TV show that they interview with the Vampire TV show?
No, it also
not
looks
yet,
very
but I hear
sexy.
Good things.
It's very good. No. It's very good. It's very good and sexy. I would absolutely recommend it. Sorry, Wizard. Mm-mm. Or Corey or whoever's next.
I believe Corey. What did you think of The Addiction?
I didn't like this movie. It was always going to be a below 10 for me. But it was going to be like in the upper echelons of that upper tier. Like it was, I was thinking like an 8 or something like that. But like, as we've talked about it, I think I'm going to regret not giving this a critical fail. Like, I think this is going to be another one where I'm going to look back and wish I would have failed it. But it I don't think it deserves that ultimately. So I'm going to land on a 4.
All right.
So charitable.
That's very charitable.
Wizard, how do you feel about your pick?
You know, I have to admit that talking about it in committee made me like it a little bit less. I was dead set on a 13 for this movie. And you know, talking to y'all and kind of sorting it out, I'm going to knock that down to an 11. Which is meaningful only to me.
It's no the shout,
I guess. Yeah, I don't, again, I don't think it's an unsuccessful movie. It's a movie that has something to say, and it feels very personal. And it's well crafted in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways it kind of picks up themes like action figures and just kind of like mashes them together and then throws them down. It's like, all right, we're done with that. And you know, I feel like there is a better movie about grace and redemption and evil somewhere in here, and we're just missing out on it just a little bit. So I'm gonna give it an 11.
Cool. Can I say to listeners, if you're interested in what we gave this and other movies before this, there will be a handy spreadsheet of all of our ratings in the show notes. Sorry, thank you.
No, absolutely. Yes, we had thoughts about this movie. We had a time with this movie. If you had a time with this movie, or you want us to have a time with another movie, write into us. We are always looking for emails. We're always looking for feedback. You can reach us at critclubcast@gmail.com. Thank you.
CritClubPodcast@gmail.com. No emails this week. Womp womp. But womp womp. Thanks again to Frida for last week's email.
And we're up on the socials at CritClubCast on Threads and on other things. I'm going to get a sticky note for next time I host. It's going to be great. But yeah, find us on the socials. Find us where you listen to podcasts. Leave us a review. Leave us some feedback. Leave us a sign that you were here. And we would much appreciate it. So I think that is about it for The Addiction this week. I am very excited to discuss what we will be turning our dread gaze onto next week, let's say. I believe it's an Angela pick next week. So Angela, what are we watching?
Oh my God, I don't know about you, but I am so tired of black and white European or otherwise cinema or heavy themes. I kind of need to get out of that. Thank you, please.
I'm here for it.
So
what's your pick?
My pick is Trisha's Wedding, and it's short. There might be a second pick. This might be Crit Club's first double feature. It comes in only at 35 minutes, and it's basically the drag queen recreation of Trisha Nixon's Wedding from 1971. I need some irreverence. I need some silliness. I need some drag. And we're getting all three of those next week. Plus a soon-to-be-determined surprise film as well. So join us. Listen. Send me an email. What do you think would be a good opener for this one? CritClubPodcast@gmail.com.
That's incredible. Just so nobody wonders, Trisha Nixon, daughter of former President Richard Nixon, I would love to see a drag performance of a presidential wedding. That sounds pretty awesome. So do write in, check out Trisha's Wedding. I think that's about it for us, except for one more thing. It's time for What Else You Watching here on Crit Club, because we watch so much more than moody black and whites, so much more than even moodier black and whites. We watch all kinds of stuff, and so we do a little segment called What Else You Watching. I'm going to go in reverse order, because it's fun. Corey,
yay.
What else you watching?
I don't have a whole lot. I was actually just like sitting here wondering, is like what have I actually been watching? I don't think I've had a lot of time to watch stuff, but I did I'm starting my second playthrough of Disco Elysium. I don't know how far I got the other time, like a year or so ago. It's stressful. It's a really stressful game for me. Just all the like mental health and like addiction stuff in that game. Like it's, I know it's good and I want to keep going with it. I hope I can, but it's not like I'm looking forward to going back and playing more of it because it's a
difficult game. Well, what led you to want to go back and play it again?
Because it's been living in my brain rent free for a while. Like it's just I played it like a year or so ago. I probably played it for about 10 hours or something like that, which I realize is probably just the tip of the iceberg with it. So I just want to go back and give it more of its due. But cool. Yeah, we'll see if I can keep it up.
I know I would love it. I just have to dig in and be like, all right, we are putting everything down and we are going to read a game for the next couple of weeks.
Well, there is voice acting now. True. So like the newest versions of it are all voice acted, and it's not exactly our reality that it takes place in. So there is a bit of, you know, fantasy type stuff of it, but a lot of it just feels real. So yeah.
Amazing. Angela, what else are you watching?
Oh, I need to pull up my note. Hold on. What was it? Oh, I watched. Okay. And this is a real tragedy because this used to be on the channel, but it's not anymore. And I would have loved to have watched it, but maybe you guys have already seen it. I watched The Lair of the White Worm.
Oh shit. I love that one.
Amazing.
Is that Poe?
What if snakes were vampires?
It's Bram Stoker.
Or something. Yeah. It has a very young Hugh Grant with a mole that apparently he had removed later. And there's a crazy lady snake lady who is also harboring a rather large possible snake god in her country house.
Lucky.
Yeah, totally lucky. Such a fun ride. Like, I think, Peter, you would enjoy it. But it's so...
Oh, it's Ken Russell. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you said that.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
It's hokey as fuck, but
lots of repressed horniness in Lair of the White Worm, like Dracula, very much a repressed.
Do you have repressed fantasies about being picked up by a hot lady while you're dressed as a Boy Scout? This is the film for you.
I do now.
What was it that I was listening to recently? It's been a long time since I've heard it, but I thought about it recently. Of somebody saying the last time that somebody will pick you up and bring you to bed is long gone away. I don't know. Sorry, that just brought me. It's like, that sounds very nice. Sorry, interrupted with that depressing thought.
No worries. You never know. Somebody might pick you up when you're old and can't walk around anymore. So there's still hope for all of us.
I'm here.
The other thing I watched, and I'm sad we'll never watch it just because it's just a fun film to talk about, is Tombstone.
That's fun.
It was super fun. It was even better than I remembered, which doesn't always happen cinematically. I actually even want to watch it again. It's that I need new films that I can just put on in the background and just enjoy whenever. And I think Tombstone is one of those movies. So that was... kind of a delightful surprise this week. Didn't think I'd get to see that, but I was given a choice. I have a friend who has like a ridiculous DVD collection, which is weirdly more satisfying than Netflix. I can sit in front of Netflix and take an hour just to pick what to watch. But I'll see Tombstone and I'm like, yes, we're watching that.
Love it.
Good times.
Really good. Really, really good. Physical media. There's like you are watching this now. There are no other options.
There's a rumor going around that Netflix is going to start doing like their own in-person video stores. I don't
Indeed.
Know if
Indeed.
Yeah.
It's probably just going to be like a store or two as a stunt. A
little pop-up shop. Peter, what else are you watching?
Well, horror movies. But before I get into that, I, as I do most weeks, every week, went to the movie theater and watched the Palme d'Or winner of 2023, Anatomy of a Fall.
Ooh.
Justine Triet, she is the one who co-wrote and directed this movie, Anatomy of a Fall. And I purposely went into it not knowing anything whatsoever. I was just enough that it's a Palme d'Or. I'm always very curious. They picked fucking Titan was a Palme d'Or winner 2 years ago. And that's like one of my favorite movies of the past like decade. But Anatomy of a Fall, I knew absolutely nothing going into it, and it turned out to be pretty a quite surprising watch. It is about a family, a writer and her husband, and their blind 10 or 11 year old child living in like a chalet on the foothills or in the Alps. The husband falls to his death. And what you think, and sort of it turns into sort of a procedural courtroom drama about what happened with this husband's accident or whatever. But it's masquerading as a courtroom drama because it's really just sort of like the lens that is used to give more context and flesh out this family's relationship to itself and sort of a lot of the hidden dramas and kindnesses that lay within. It's very subtle. It's very quiet. It's a very soft movie that I think a lot of people will probably be pretty frustrated by the ending, but I found it to be a really, really complicated and very emotionally complex viewing. Like, I'm not sure if it's, I don't know if I had the Palme d'Or to give, I'm not sure if I would give it to this, but I'm absolutely sure that I was glad to watch it and would really recommend people check out Justine Triet's Anatomy of a Fall. Very fascinating movie. On the other end of the spectrum, I did continue to watch many, many, many horror films over the past week. I probably watched at least 10 to 12, but one that I should mention is a brand new, only because I was so surprised in how absolutely good it was. I think I've said on this podcast how much I enjoy the found footage movie from, when did the first one come out? From like 2015, Hell House LLC.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
Have you watched it?
Not yet. It's on my list.
It is a super solid movie. That is a super absolutely solid movie. And there was a Hell House LLC 2, which is terrible. And there is a Hell House LLC 3, Lake of Fire, which is somehow even worse. And so imagine my surprise when, what is the fucking title of this? Hell House L, oh no, hold on. Oh, I got it written down. Hell House LLC Origins, The Carmichael Manor, dropped on Shudder a couple days ago.
A lot of title.
Let me tell you, very good. Ooh. A very good movie. I was so surprised how successful this movie was at telling a story. And let me say, as a person who does fucking nothing but watch horror movies, I don't get creeped out very often. This had one or two little things that were like, that was creepy as shit. And that was a very successful, creepy moment or scene. So my two recommendations, The Anatomy of a Fall and Hell House LLC Origins, The Carmichael Manor.
Damn. That's awesome.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, everybody. Yeah.
Wizard, what have you been watching?
A couple of things for me. Two little Halloween features that I wanted to shout out. I watched The Autopsy of Jane Doe. A recommend from Peter, starring Brian Cox and a couple other people whose names I can't remember. Really excellent, excellent, like little locked room horror film.
I called it a ride, I think I remember.
You
that,
did,
was that
yes.
accurate?
Yes, very much a ride. Very much, cool. Very much like that, like roller coaster rising action. And then once things really kick off, I was clutching my pizza and spilling my soda and just, oh, this is so scary. This is good. I had a great time watching The Autopsy of Jane Doe. Very effective little horror film. The true horror though was when I got home and I was describing it to Laura and I explained some of the details of the autopsy and she's like, that's not how you separate a rib cage. And I was like, we should talk more. That's exciting. Also caught a little Japanese feature called Bloody Muscle Bodybuilder in Hell, which is 63 minutes of a mid-90s VHS shot kind of remake of the first Evil Dead movie. Some shots are like just outright, the whole finale is outright like lifted from Evil Dead, and it is a fascinating movie. It is definitely in the, you know, so bad it's good kind of genre of Halloween film. No need to explain the plot. It is Evil Dead in a Japanese suburb instead of a cabin in the woods. And everything else from then on is pretty much the same, with some like light touches that make it more Japanese than anything else. Yeah, super fun, very silly. Really gave me an appreciation for Bruce Campbell's talent as like a physical actor, because there's so much slapstick in the Evil Dead films that it turns out not just anyone can do. Being menaced by like a bloody monster puppet, some people do not make that look good, and this movie did not make that look good at all. Bruce Campbell always makes it look good. So shout out to Bloody Muscle Bodybuilder in Hell. Upcoming tomorrow, this is not a movie, but I'm pretty excited. I'm gonna go see Jagged Little Pill, the Alanis Morissette musical, which I am super jazzed for. I'm a big Alanis Morissette fan, and I don't know what to expect from this.
Lily Taylor always reminds me of Alanis Morissette, and vice versa.
Is it the flannels and the sort of disaffection?
Just small, dark. Yeah. Paired. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. Two of Wizard's 90s crushes intersect.
But only one has been on You Can't Do That on television.
Very true. Very true. Yeah. That's something to think about. So I'm excited to check out Jagged Little Pill tomorrow. And when we come back next week, I will tell you a little bit about it. I'm sure it will be angsty. But that'll be for next week. That is it for us from Crit Club. Thank you for joining us for our little chit-chat about the edition. Happy belated Halloween to all who celebrate. And we'll catch you next week with Angela. What are we watching?
Trish's Wedding.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Trish.
Congratulations, Trish. Yeah. Your dad's a dickhead.
He's ruined American politics forever.
Hey, it's a long line of people who have ruined American politics. And we can talk a little bit about that next week. Reach out to us at Crit Club Podcast, Crit Club Cast, all of the places that you can find us. It has been a blast, everybody. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.